From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about professionalism with special guest, Dan Mall. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Craft. Craft lets you create a content management experience that is perfectly tailored to your client's needs. Want to check it out? Just head over to demo.buildwithcraft.com and you can get your own demo site to fool around within minutes.
Before we get into the show, Leia, how awesome is it that we've already reached 50 episodes since the rebrand of Control ClickCast?
I know, and it's been really fantastic to see our little show has been gaining traction recently. So in our last episode about podcasting 101, we mentioned we were going to try to implement more tracking stats. Mm-hmm. So I just checked our PodTrack stats the other day, and we've had over 10,000 downloads in the past 90 days.
That blows my mind.
I know.
We're so grateful for everyone's support, since listeners like you are the ones who've helped us get to 50. So thanks for subscribing, tweeting about us, and sharing our show. Every little bit helps.
Yes, thank you. And I'm so excited about today's guest being on episode 50.
Yeah, it's kind of like a benchmark episode in a sense of, you know, it's number 50, but today we're going to talk about professionalism, because we've had a number of episodes recently where we talked about the importance of so-called soft skills, like how critical communication, planning, empathy, and even just being a good employee are to a successful web career. Mm-hmm. So we thought it would be timely to sort of dive into this topic of professionalism deeper, and who better than to help us than Dan Mall, co-host of the renowned Businessology podcast that teaches designers how to run better businesses. In addition to being a podcast host, Dan is a creative director and advisor with extensive experience leading design teams and crafting processes for successful digital work. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, Dan, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, I can. I'm a designer. I live in Philadelphia. I'm married to my wife, Emily, and I have two kids, two daughters, Sitta and Charlotte. And with all the time that I'm not spending with them, I try to do design work and work with design teams to make nice things.
So you mentioned one of your daughter's names is Sitta. Isn't that a character from a book?
It sort of is. So I don't know if any of you remember this, but there was a movie around, I don't know, I guess 10 or 15 years ago called The Divine...
Yes. I thought that's what it was. Sisterhood.
Because I don't even remember the title of that movie. And my wife and I were dating at the time. She's my girlfriend at the time, and she went to see it. And we were pretty young. And she came back and she told me about the movie, and she said, oh, there was a character in that movie named Sitta Lee. Maybe one day if we ever have a daughter, we'll name our daughter that, ha, ha, ha. And we joked about it. And then years later when we got married and when she got pregnant and we were trying to pick out names, we were like, remember that name, Sitta Lee? And so we named our daughter Sitta Lee after that. And we tried to look it up and figure out like where it's from, but there's actually no origin. We found out that the author made it up for the book that eventually became the movie. So it's just kind of a made up name, but we really liked it so much.
Oh, I love that story.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So that's where Sitta comes from.
So let's go ahead and dive into today's topic. So how would you define professionalism?
That is so difficult. I've never been good at defining stuff, but fortunately for me, there's a really great, I guess treatise is the only way that I can talk about it, written by a guy named Andy Rutledge, who's a great designer. And he wrote this whole like book about what it means to be a design professional. And there's a website devoted to it. There's an ebook, but you can read the whole thing online. It's designprofessionalism.com. And there's even like a charter that you can sign that's like, I commit to being a design professional. And so he has a bunch of qualifications for what design professional means. And there are things, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there are things like there's great responsibility that comes with it. There's accountability. You have specialized theoretical knowledge. You may have institutional preparation. You have autonomy. You have clients rather than customers. Like all these really great things that make up what a design professional is. I think if I had to sum it up, it would just be about being very, very good at a particular set of things and then acting responsible both morally and ethically to the people that you're doing the work for.
I think that's a pretty good summary in a nutshell. The basically doing what you set out to do and then having the moral and ethical, you know, background to execute as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the thing that he, like, he does a good job in all of this writing about holding up certain parts of that, right? So there's, it's not just doing something, it's doing something well and doing something to a standard of quality.
Right.
And then also, like, doing it, so doing it to the best of your ability and the best of sort of the industry, you know, to look up to that. And then just doing a good job, like being upstanding about it and being trustworthy and all those kinds of things.
Wow, this is the first time I'm hearing of it. I'm actually looking through, it's available as, I guess, an ebook, but it's also available online.
It's pretty fantastic.
This is amazing. Yeah, it really is. Wow, what a, gosh, this should be taught in schools, you know, for like UX design or design, just to, gosh, no better way to prepare yourself than to understand what the standards are to start with.
Yeah, exactly. And I know Andy's he's put a lot of time into researching this and studying it and writing about it and talking about it on podcasts. So, I mean, there's a lot of research and a lot of time and a lot of experience that has gone into writing this. It wasn't like, you know, I don't think he just sat down one day and just like churned out 25,000 words. I think this is like months or years worth of culmination of what he's understood about being a design professional.
Well, so I guess the definition of being unprofessional is literally the opposite of what you just described. But I think some of the things that occur to me based on my own experience is that I think far too often we may think that professionalism, especially within our industry, kind of extends to our skill set and maybe not necessarily how we interact with people. And some people may not realize that it may be unprofessional to, you know, not return phone calls,
yes,
to not acknowledge you received an email, even if you can't respond to it right away, or just, you know, things like that. So are there any kind of traits or behaviors you've seen within amongst design professionals or web professionals that, you know, maybe are just sort of subconsciously unprofessional?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I'll answer sort of the opposite of like what makes someone a professional to me. For me, if I had to pick one trait, it would have to be communication. So the people that communicate and over-communicate, I treat them as professionals because I feel like they're treating me as a professional and doing me a professional courtesy by communicating about what they're doing or what they're not doing. And I hold that higher than I hold the quality of their work. So as an example, you know, I've worked with people that are, you know, excellent designers and developers. I'm thinking of, you know, of one person in particular who's just probably like one of the best people in the world at what he does. But every time I work with him, he misses deadlines. And I'm like, right, like, I don't know anyone that can do what he does better than him, but I still am hesitant to hire him for projects or work with him because I'm like, I know that if he says to me, let's do, you know, this thing is due on Wednesday, I'll have it by Wednesday, that I have to bake in Friday. You know, I have to sort of overcompensate for that. So I would much rather take someone who does mediocre or above average work that is on time and is communicative about their work over someone who has a high quality of work, but just sort of doesn't respect kind of the soft stuff around that.
I couldn't agree more. You know, Dan, you and I had an opportunity to work together a little bit with Web Standard Sherpa. And that put me in a really unique position where I was dealing with lots of really talented designers and developers, not to produce web work, but to produce content, which is a whole different skill set, you know, that you may or may not have. But, you know, when you sign up to contribute to a publication, there becomes a sort of expectation of you communicating and meeting deadlines and things like that. And it was an eye-opening experience. It seems that deadlines almost seem like they're flexible in our industry.
I hate that. And I know, I'm guilty as well, so I know I'm certainly not.
I am not saying this as I'm literally behind on a deadline right now. I guess my point is that what I try and do, and I know I would have appreciated it when I was working with Sherpa, is that when I'm behind on a deadline, I know I'm behind about 2 days before the deadline comes up. And I usually give someone a heads up and say, this is behind, this is going to affect it in this manner. And I continue to keep them posted. And that's something that I would have loved. I would have loved to have that kind of communication, even though it's sort of saying, hey, I'm dropping the ball or I'm doing something that's not great, but I respect your time. I respect your input in this. So I'm going to let you know about it.
Yep, absolutely. I think that's probably one of the most professional things that someone can do for someone else. It's just about courtesy. It's about respecting someone else. Even if you're dropping the ball, just letting them know that. And I think that's, you know, that's a matter of scoping. You know, one of the things that I work on a lot with my apprentices is we learn to scope. you know, from month two of their apprenticeship, I try to teach them how to scope. And because when you're late on something, you should know way in advance that you're going to be late. Because, you know, if you're trying to deliver something to a client and they're sitting at their desk until 5 p.m. waiting for you to deliver this thing and you don't deliver it until midnight that night, who knows if they're just sitting around waiting for you to send them that thing? Like, that's just so, it's just not courteous at all. But you, like, you know way before you're missing a deadline. If you're doing your work properly, you know the day before you're going to miss it, or sometimes the week before you're going to miss that deadline. If you say to a client a week in advance, hey, I'm really sorry, I'm behind on a couple of things. Do you mind if I have 2 days extra on this? It's usually like, yeah, no problem. Thanks for the heads up. But if you tell a client that at 4:59 when the thing is due at 5 o'clock, of course they're going to be upset with you. Like, that's unprofessional. So I think a lot of it is just a matter of knowing where you are in your process. And then as soon as you miss a small deadline, you know you're going to blow the whole thing. You got to let somebody know about that, whether it's your coworkers or your project manager or your client or whoever it is that you're accountable to.
I think that example leads nicely into my next question, because I was going to ask if you can learn how to be professional. And it sounds to me that at least with some things, like you were describing, your apprentices are learning how to scope and understand where they are in a schedule. That's something you can learn easily.
Yep. Absolutely. I mean, I think most skills in our industry can be learned. You know, I certainly believe that as a philosophy of my own. Otherwise, I wouldn't even do an apprenticeship. Like, I wouldn't, you know, I feel like all of the skills can be learned. The design, the dev, the professionalism, all of that stuff. Like, the stuff that comes with you is your own character, but all of the skills, hard and soft, I think are things that you learn. And you may have predispositions towards some of them that make some easier than others for you, but I think all of it is they're all muscles, right? It's like when going to the gym, you don't go to the gym the first day that you ever gone to the gym and you're already buff. Like, you got to work those muscles. And sometimes your calves and your biceps and whatever, they are weak because you haven't worked them out. And then the more you work them out, the stronger they become. So I think the same thing applies to professionalism or design or any of that stuff. The more you practice design, the better designer you're going to be. The more you practice handing things in on time, the more you're professional you're going to be. So I think it's definitely a skill that you learn both by your own mistakes as well as your own successes, and you know, all of that kind of aggregates into you being a professional.
So I'm curious, though, we kind of mentioned a lot of things about, you know, the web professionalism and design, because that's the world we live in. Do you feel that there's a difference between how professionalism is perceived on the web versus other industries?
I think so. I mean, I think, well, I don't know about other industries. I think any industry that is sort of craft-based, I think an appreciation for the craft is kind of prerequisite number one for being a professional, right? Because I think, like, or at least it goes hand in hand with some of the soft skills. Because if you hand things in on time and it's just garbage, like, that's not really worth much, right? At least you got it in on time, you know, bonus points for that. But if it doesn't fulfill the requirements of the assignment or the brief, or it doesn't actually do the thing that the person who hired you wants it to do, I mean, that's only so professional. So I think certainly the appreciation for the craft part is part of the professionalism thing. You do have to be good at what you do. And I think that's what one of the things I like most about what Andy has written, is that it kind of keeps both of those things in balance. You have to have the soft stuff, but you also have to be really good at what you do. And continuing, I think part of what he wrote is that a good design professional continues to work at their craft, and they continue to try and get better at it by doing, you know, attending workshops and conferences and practicing what they do and doing all of that kind of stuff. So I think it certainly goes hand in hand with it. As compared to other professions, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I've been a web designer longer than I've been, I guess, anything else. So I'm not really sure how other industries really treat that.
I think the reason why I asked this question is that our clients aren't necessarily in the web industry. Do you know what I'm saying? So, like, they're, you know, they've got a service or a product that they are trying to sell, and they have no idea how to work on the web. And then they speak to us, and sometimes, and this is an unfortunate thing, they hire us because of other people in our industry not fulfilling the basics of professionalism. Have you encountered that? And what do they say to you?
I think I've encountered that, although it does put up a big red flag for me. You know, so when somebody says, like, hey, we'd love to work with you. I'm like, that's awesome. That's a great compliment. And I'd love to talk to you. And they say, and we'd love to work with you because, you know, we have some baggage. These people weren't great to us, or, you know, we didn't like working with them. That always makes me question a little bit. You know, that's certainly not a thing where I go, oh, I'm walking away from this because it's not going to be good. But it's a conversation point now. You know, what didn't you like about those other folks? Is it something about them? Were they not professional enough? And so I try to dig deeply into that because I think that affects your relationship in the same way, you know, working with a client is a relationship in the same way that when you first date somebody, you ask them how many people they've dated, you know, like it's kind of the same thing. You want to, at the risk of being crude here, you want to know your chances of getting STIs, you know? So I think the same applies when working with clients.
Oh, Dad, that's amazing.
I think it's very true. And I think not only does it, it also reflects another level of professionalism. You know, as you get farther in your career, you, the general you, you know, I remember when I was first starting out, I took any project that came my way. And as I've become more professional in terms of valuing the investment of my time in the business, valuing the kind of clients that I want to work with, that you do want to have those conversations. You do want to look out for the red flag that if one of the reasons they didn't like the previous person was really something with the client.
Yep.
You know, knowing those things, knowing the questions to ask so you don't get yourself in an engagement that you're really going to be unhappy in.
Yep, absolutely. You know, I think, Leah, to kind of to your question about the other professions, as I think about it, mm-hmm. I'm a big basketball fan. I grew up playing basketball. I grew up in North Philly, and I like watching basketball. And I think about, like, there's a bunch of basketball players that are excellent at what they do, but they don't show up to practice and they get canned, you know? So like, I live in Philadelphia. I root for the 76ers. They haven't been that good for a long time. They're starting to get good now. But, you know, Allen Iverson was one of the star players on the Sixers for a long time. And he was notorious for just never coming to practice or coming to practice drunk. And like, as good as he was, he's an excellent basketball player. But as good as he was, he just wasn't being professional because he just wouldn't show up and help his team. And he would just kind of show up on game day. And you know, that's partly why the Sixers never won a title when Iverson was part of it, because he just wasn't professional. So I think that quality exists in all industries, you know, in some form or another.
So do you think that it's, if the definition of professionalism or the expectations involved with being a professional is the same as someone who's first starting their career versus someone who's established, is the expectation higher for someone who's established, or should it be the same regardless?
I don't think it should be the same regardless, because I think, you know, the old Uncle Ben quote from Spider-Man, which is that with great power comes great responsibility. When you start out as a designer, you don't have great power, you know, and that's the nature of it, right? You learn to get that power. You learn it by how you command language and how you command tools and how you project in a meeting and how you can walk into a boardroom. Like, that stuff that I don't expect any student or apprentice or starting designer to be able to do well, because they haven't exercised that muscle. So I think definitely the stakes are higher as you get more professional. And I think it's not a coincidence that people that have been doing what they're doing for a long time do get bigger budget, higher stake projects. I think it would be lopsided if, you know, whoever, Nike, you know, hired some student out of school to redesign their website. It would just be the wrong amount of responsibility for the wrong amount of power. So I think they do work in tandem, where the more you learn, the more you grow, the more professional you become, the more responsibility you can take on, and you can be ethical without saying, like, yes, this is this gigantic project with a gigantic budget, and yes, I do have the skill to take it on and be a professional through it.
Yeah, I was going to also ask, do you think that there's an expectation? Well, see, I find this is hard because I can't say that I experienced this when I was working with like another web agency. It was when I was working as an employee for a large Fortune 500 company, and I was just a web professional on a marketing team, so I wouldn't have called it web industry. And the executives in that company, I felt like they were the least professionally behaved people in the organization, almost that they had risen to a level of, as crazy as it sounds, responsibility and prominence, and I'm sure they were making good money to reflect that, and yet they would have their own schedules. I literally experienced one of them screaming at someone over the phone, and you could hear it in the whole office. And it almost felt like there was like, well, I got to this level, so I don't have to maintain what I, you know, use to get to this level. Do you think that's something that is a trend, or not a trend, but is something that can happen as people kind of move up and get distant from what got them there?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I think there's a lot of factors that go into that. So there's a thing, there's like a management theory called the Peter Principle. And the Peter Principle says, and I'm just reading from the Wikipedia page, I looked it up while you were talking. It's that the selection of a candidate for a position is based on the candidate's performance in their current role rather than on their abilities relevant to the intended role, right? And so another way to say that is managers rise to the level of their own incompetence, right? So you get promoted and promoted and promoted where you can no longer do the job that you're actually good for. So, you know, I think a lot of people, especially in our industry, end up in their positions by accident, right? Like how many of us started as like, I just want to design stuff. And then all of a sudden you're managing design teams or you're leading something and like no one set out to be a leader. They set out to be a coder or a designer or an illustrator, you know? And then all of a sudden as you become more professional, people think, well, like you can be in charge of other people. And sometimes that's a welcome thing and sometimes that's not a welcome thing. So I definitely think the Peter Principle comes into play where you do have some CEOs that are just CEOs by accident, you know, and they're not good at that job, but that's just kind of where they are. Like it's the same thing when you start your own design company, you're by default the creative director, even if you don't have any experience with creative direction, just because there's nobody else there, you know?
Right.
So I think the thing to realize is that you're just as much creative director as you are janitor, because there's also no one else there to water the plants or sweep the floors. So I think a lot of that applies to our industry where you can kind of make your own path. Like people start agencies by accident because they want to just do good work. And then all of a sudden they've got a team of 10 people just by surprise. And so I think there's certainly a lot of that at play. You know, the other thing too that I'm a bit sensitive to is like I've been part of places where I've heard people yell and scream at clients and all that. And I always thought that that was pretty wrong and pretty rough. But I've had one mentor say to me, you know, sometimes clients just need to hear you drop the F-bomb to know that you're serious. And I thought that was like one of the best pieces of advice that someone gave me. Now, I usually don't use bad language at all, but there have been phone calls where like that it's for effect, you know, where like sometimes you need that for people to understand how serious you are about it. And I remember being on one call last year, I did a project and a friend of mine who was a tech director on the project, we were on Skype in the back channel and on the phone and he was screaming at the client. He told me before the phone call, hey, I'm going to yell on this call. Is that cool? And I was like, yeah, that's cool. And so he's screaming and dropping F-bombs and doing all this stuff. And all the while typing to me like, hey, is this okay? Like, is this fine? So totally calm, totally composed. But that was what the project needed in order to get it on track, in order to reset the expectations. Like, so in that case, I think the best way for him to be a professional was to be able to kind of let loose. So I don't know. I think it's tricky. There's a lot of factors that kind of go into it.
Well, I think this just goes back to your initial distillation of professionalism, which is communication. If you understand how your client or your employees behave and react, then you adjust your communication style in order to get the behavior that you need. You know, like if we take it to like other industries, for example, like you mentioned sports and basketball, you know, coaches are notorious on being extremely hard on their players. And, you know, we could debate over how far they should go. But obviously, that technique has worked really, really well to help motivate a lot of players to achieve their highest standards of play, you know? So, and what I love about what you just mentioned here is that professionalism isn't one standard definition. It's all about context and the situation you're in.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen people like that are professionals in a suit and tie, and I've seen people that are like completely dressed down that are more professional than people in a suit and tie. So I think you're right. It does come in a lot of different flavors.
Right. So Dan, let's talk about some specific traits. We've talked about communication. What else is another good trait that a very professional web worker has? You know, what I mentioned at the outset is we've had a lot of episodes on that have mentioned soft skills like empathy or planning or, like you had mentioned earlier, good communication. Can you describe some other things that a web worker who's professional would demonstrate?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I hold as high as communication is accountability. And it certainly goes hand in hand with communication. And it's tough to nail down, like, what does accountability mean? And what does it mean when you're accountable to someone or somebody's accountable to you? I went to a conference 2 years ago called Brooklyn Beta. And there was a great speaker at Brooklyn Beta's, Cory Booker, who was at the time, he was, I believe, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, and now is, a senator. And he spoke about accountability because one of the things that was famous about the way that he ran his administration in New Jersey was that things were getting done, you know, and it's like one of the most crime-ridden cities in the world. But suddenly when he became the mayor, he turned a lot of things around. And a lot of people attribute that to his use of like social media and technology. And so one of the questions somebody asked him was, well, how do you get your staff to actually commit to change and do it? You know, is it that you guys use Twitter a lot, or is it that you guys use technology? And he's like, it has nothing to do with that. It has all to do with accountability. And so the follow-up question was, well, what do you mean by that? And he gave a formula for accountability, which I'll never forget. He said, accountability means three things. So the first thing in accountability is that you need to have a standard. And that's a thing that everyone has to accept and agree to, right? So whatever that standard is, it could be a high standard or a low standard or medium standard, but everyone just has to agree to it. The second thing is that you have to have a way to measure that standard. So a standard for us might be you come into work at 10 o'clock, right? That's a standard that we all agree to. If somebody comes in at 10:05, they have not met that standard. If somebody comes in at 9:55, they have met that standard, like pretty easy to measure. And then the third thing is that you need to have consequences for that standard not being met. And those consequences can be both positive and negative. So if somebody comes in at 9:55, maybe they get a reward for coming in early. If somebody comes in at 10:05, maybe they get penalized for coming in late. So that's a bit of a silly example, but accountability sort of has those three points to it. So when I try to work with people on teams, I try to establish what the accountability is. So how am I accountable to you? What standard are we going to agree to? How are we going to measure that? And then what are we going to do if it doesn't happen? And what are we going to do if it does? I think that's probably what I like most about the people that I do like working with most, is that the commonality is that they're the most accountable people that I know. So when I work with people that are very accountable, it almost doesn't matter how good the quality of work is. I just know that whatever they say they're going to do, they're going to do. So if I say, hey, can you build this thing that you've never built before? Yes. Great. I can trust that that's going to get done. And so I think that's one of the things, that's one of the things that I also hold as highly as sort of the communication part, is definitely accountability. I love working with accountable people. It makes me more accountable and it challenges me to do that. And so I think there's this really great thing that's being built up when you work with a lot of accountable people on a team.
That actually introduces a new question for me. Do you think being professional causes the people around you to be professional?
I think so. I think
like raises your game.
Yeah, totally. I think the idea of leading by example is not a fiction. I've seen it happen before. I know certainly when I've seen other people do things that are professional, I'm always like, I want to do that. Like, I could do that, or I don't know how to do that. I'd like to learn how to do that. So it certainly works for me. You know, I know a lot of people learn differently, and so it doesn't work for a lot of people. But I think that when you do something that other people can admire and see, and you can be an example for them, I think that is a really good sort of leadership and management and professional thing to do.
So I'm curious about action. So I feel like communication and accountability, those are all traits. What are some actions a web worker can do to convey these aspects of professionalism?
Ooh, that's a tough one. That is a really tough one. I don't know. This is certainly my own personal philosophy. So I don't know that this is like a thing that everyone should do, but this is the way that I like to work. When I work on a team, I try to think about, what are the ways that I can best serve all the people on the team? So how can I look out for everybody? Because I feel like if I look out for everybody, there's probably somebody looking out for me. And then I don't have to worry about being looked out for. If I'm the only one looking out for me and I'm not looking out for anybody else, then probably everybody else is doing that same thing. Especially like when that comes from the top of the chain, or what, you know, however you want to refer to it. If I, you know, if I'm the creative director on a project, people are looking to me for the example of, to set for how the project is going to be. So if I act like I'm out for number one, then they're going to act the same way. If instead I look like, you know, I'm out for somebody else and I'm willing to help them over what I need to get done, I feel like that is contagious as well. So I think that's certainly one of the things that I try to do. I try to act out. Like, I don't state that anywhere. I'm not like, okay, I'm going to look out for you today. You know, like, it's not an explicit thing. And I think it would be weird if it was. But I try to do that, and I try to set that example. And when people have questions about what they should be doing, you know, I'll always point them to like, well, maybe you could help this person, or maybe you could help this person because they're struggling on this thing. And I feel like that makes projects go really well when people are looking out for each other. So I think that's one of those things that you just sort of do. And if it catches on, great. And if it doesn't, that's okay too. And then, you know, and you can be more or less proactive about trying to enact that on your project. But I think that's one of the things that I try to do most.
One thing that occurred to me is, you know, Leah and I, when we're working with a new client or even someone who we haven't signed yet, especially because we're remote, we very rarely get to meet prospects or our clients face to face. And so it's not challenging, but I feel like we have to go an extra mile to convey our professionalism. I think it's easier for us to convey our skills because we can point to things and show that to them when they're evaluating us. But in terms of conveying how we operate and that we're professionals who have, we have our high standards are for ourselves, but they're also for our clients. We do expect our clients to reciprocate. And so especially at the beginning of an engagement with a prospect, you know, we're sort of checking to see, are they responsive to us? We also err on the side of over communication, making sure everything is explicitly clear, and we want to see that in return. And so, you know, we take extra steps to make sure we're checking in by a phone, that we send emails. Once we're engaged with a client, we do regular weekly check-ins, which is something that we hadn't always done. And it's a simple little thing that really makes a big difference to keep everyone on the same page. Because normally we would just one-on-one update the main contact, but we're updating the entire client contact list every week so everyone knows what's going on. And I think it really conveys that we're taking the project seriously. We take their time seriously. We're giving them an opportunity to ask questions, you know, putting something in front of them. And it feels very actionable, like an action that demonstrates how we communicate.
I love that. I think that makes such a difference. Over the last year, I've been trying to do this thing where I'm like writing down philosophies for myself. Like, here are ways that I would like to be and act and do. And one of those philosophies that has emerged for me is that I think the clients freak out when they can't see the future. And so my job as a professional is to help them see the future. And it could be the future of their app or the future of their career path or the future of their trajectory at their company or whatever it is. But like, all of my tools and processes and conversations are designed to help them see the future a little bit more. So like, from a tool standpoint, I made a thing called a project hub that just shows them, like, here are the upcoming milestones on this project. And at any point, you can come back to this project hub and you can see next week we're going to deliver this thing, the week after that, something else. And that's all subject to change. But at any point, they can just look and see what the next 6 weeks are going to be. And if anything changes, I'll have a phone call with them or I'll let them know in some way. But it makes such a difference because when clients don't know what's coming, like you deliver a design round that they're not really happy with, and they don't know that it's going to be corrected, right? But you could say, well, look, next week we have a revision cycle plan. So you'll see some more stuff next week. And something as simple as that helps them to go like, oh, okay, cool. Like, got it. And it's not an issue anymore. So I think like that's one of the things that I try to do is help them see the future somehow. It could be through a tool. It could be through a conversation. It could be through anything like that. I think our industry has a tendency to only want to talk to clients when things are going well. And I think the opposite needs to happen. My friend Greg Story wrote this great post about using the phone. You know, like I think he wrote it on Medium. And it's like, he's like, whenever something happens, just pick up the phone and call somebody. Like, call your client. Something bad, something good, whatever. Just pick up the phone and call. And I forget where I heard this from, but I think it was Richard Banfield, who runs Fresh Tilled Soil. He said, email and Slack and Basecamp and all that stuff are communication tools for when things are going well. And the phone is a communication tool for when things are going poorly. So I think like, and we tend to do the opposite, right? Like we celebrate all the good stuff. And then when the bad stuff happens, we're like, oh man, we don't want to talk about this stuff. But I think the more we can get in the habit of just talking about everything, then the bad stuff doesn't seem as bad. Because if the only time that you're using the phone is to call your client, then as soon as they see your number on their caller ID, they're not going to pick it up because they know it's bad news. So I love the idea that you're talking about of weekly check-ins, because it just becomes normal. Like, here's the progress. And that progress could be bad or it could be good. You know, so a lot of projects that I've been doing, we've been doing weekly check-ins, and sometimes that check-in is like, everything is full speed ahead, we're doing really well, you know, here's the status of things. Other times it's, you know, we're at the risk of blowing launch because we need this X or Y or Z from your team and we don't have those things and we've been asking them for 3 weeks. And when that's the only type of phone call you have with a client, that becomes a big deal. But if that's just part of regular status, you know, that's protocol. That's just the way that we work. So I think sort of going back to the communication point, I think that's such a big deal. And it has nothing to do with how good the design is or how clean the code is or how fast the CMS loads or any of that stuff. You know, that stuff is on top of it or is at least a balance to it. But, you know, the communication is just as important.
So we've been talking a lot about professionalism, mostly in the lens of a vendor-client relationship. What about an employee-to-employee relationship? How do you convey professionalism with your peers?
I think it's about motivating your peers, right? I think, and kind of the same thing that I just mentioned about like looking out for everybody else. If you're looking out for everybody else, then chances are somebody's looking out for you and everybody gets taken care of. There's this great, I guess it's an allegory of the long spoons where everybody, and there's kind of there's a YouTube video about this too, where people are sitting around a hole and in the middle of the hole, there's like a one column that has soup in it. And everyone has a long spoon, and their long spoons can reach the soup. And so everyone has these long spoons that they're trying to feed themselves with, but the spoons are so long and awkward that they can't really do it. And they end up fighting over the soup. So somebody knocks over somebody's spoon, somebody breaks someone else's spoon, and it's just, you know, it's just a really bad situation until one of them realizes, actually, if I take the spoon and I try to feed someone who's sitting across from me, that's a much better experience. And then once one person does it, the other person does it, and everybody starts feeding each other. And it's this like really happy, you know, just great video to watch. It's like a minute long. But I feel like that's a great way that projects should go. If everybody's looking out for everybody else, then the project succeeds, you know. And I think my philosophy about that is that projects are about people, not about the output. I think a lot of us focus so much time on like, well, it's like my jQuery has to be really tight, or my, you know, these animations have to be really good, and that's what's going to make the project. I don't think so. I think if people have learned things, and if you helped your client's business, and if they feel like they're empowered because of the work that you did, like, it doesn't matter if your code is clean or if your design is the best design that you've made. Like, that's what they hired you for. You know, maybe they did hire you to write clean code, and that's a part of professionalism, but they certainly are paying you for the other stuff too.
Do you think that professional practices or expectations of professionalism shift if you are an employee and then become like self-employed running your own shop?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, and certainly I'm biased because I am a shop owner now as opposed to employee. And so my last 3 years have been with the mindset of an owner as opposed to the mindset of an employee. But I have been an employee for the last 10 years before that. So I think I can still empathize with that role. I think the stakes are a little bit higher when you're an owner, and especially if you have payroll, right? Especially if you have people that you are paying. That is scary. Like, I don't employ anybody full time, but even the risk of hiring contractors and having to pay them, that's a big responsibility. And I think on top of that, like, there are conversations that you have to have with clients that when you employ people or when you're an employee, you just don't have to have. So there are sort of principle to principle conversations about invoicing or about when to submit a deliverable or when you get paid about something that are difficult conversations to have that a lot of employees, I would say most employees, have never experienced before, just because that's never been their role. You know, that's always been the role of the owner or the CFO or, you know, whoever the person is at that agency that's sort of a non-employee. So I think certainly the stakes are a little bit higher. And I think that most employers see the benefit of that as well because they get rich off of that stuff. You know, like the more responsibility you have, the more risk you're taking, the more potential for your profit. So that's why agency owners do fairly well compared to their employees, is because they take on more responsibility, they take on more risk, and so they see more of the reward.
I've spent probably the vast majority of my career as an employee. I've only been working for myself now, I guess, 5 years I'm in. And I think I'm at some things vastly more professional now that I'm a business owner. And some things, if I was still using the employee benchmark, I'm far less professional. Like, when I was an employee, I never showed up on time, ever.
Me too.
I
mean,
I can't think of a single time I showed up at work on time. And I always took long lunch breaks. And in my head, I justified it because I was like, oh, I did some great work. You know, sort of that younger person mentality or less experienced person mentality, thinking that the work was good enough. And I also probably was a very casual dresser compared to the way everyone else dressed. I'm still that same way today. You know, that has not changed at all. I don't start work until probably 10 a.m. each day, and I'm not even dressed right now. I'm wearing my pajamas still. So, like, that's still who I am. But I operate still very professionally and at even a more elevated level, like what you were just describing as the owner. I feel so much more responsibility. And not just since working for myself, since Leia came on board, since there's now someone else who counts on my ability to keep this business running, that level of responsibility just forces me to have those hard conversations. I do not like disappointing people, and I don't like conflict, and I hate having a difficult conversation with the client, but I have no choice. There's nothing else for me to do. And because I'm not skilled in those areas, I literally write drafts of what I need to say to the client before I ever either send an email or pick up the phone. So at least I have some point of reference, since it's a very uncomfortable sort of emotional experience that you go through, but you have no choice. So you have to find a way to be professional amongst your, you know, discomfort.
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly identify with a piece of that. And then another piece of that, I feel like I'm the opposite, where when I was an employee, I never came to work on time. Like, I'm chronically bad at being on time. My wife is excellent at being on time. She's very punctual. And for her, it's not punctuality for the sake of being punctual. It's because she sees it as a courtesy, right? Like, if you say somebody, I'm going to be there at 10, well, be there at 10. It's courteous to do that. And I just never, that never really sunk in for me. I'm like, well, look, I'm doing the work. If I want to show up at 10:15, I'll show up at 10:15, you know, like, and I'll stay 15 minutes late, you know, that's fine. And I never really understood that until I became an owner, specifically until I started running the apprenticeship that I run. Because what I realized is it's not about the time we start. Like, I don't care if we start at 10 or 11 or 9 or 8 or whatever, but if you say you're going to do something, do that thing. If you say you're going to be in at 10, be in at 10. Because if I can trust that you're going to be in at the time that you say you're going to be in, I could also trust that you're going to make this deadline when you say you're going to do that. Or I could also trust that when you say you're going to learn this thing that you don't know how to do, that you're going to learn that too. So for me, it didn't really click to me that that was an indication of what I'm actually going to be, the more responsibility that I'm going to be able to get. And I just never put those two things together until I became an owner, and specifically until I started running the apprenticeship. So what I say to my apprentices is, I don't care what time we start. If you want to start at 11, just tell me when to start at 11, but then be in your seat at 11. You know, like, it could be 12, it could be 2 p.m. if you want. I'm happy to agree to 2 p.m., but please be in your seat at 2 p.m. because that sends me a signal that I can trust you. And if I can trust you with the small thing, I can trust you with a bigger thing. I can trust you with paying you for a project, or paying you a lot of money for a project, or giving you a lot of responsibility on a project. So I feel like that all kind of builds up. The same thing with the way that I dress. I love wearing ripped jeans for some reason. And I remember always getting yelled at for going to meetings in ripped jeans. And I just never understood what the big deal was. I'm like, you know what? Like, I'm more fashionable than anybody else in that meeting. But it wasn't about that. It was just about courtesy and respect and, you know, and things that I didn't really understand until that. So now, you know, like, I try to dress nicer because I think there are people that take leads from me. And if they perceive me as being sloppy in my dress, then maybe they'll perceive me as being sloppy on their project. And that's not the thing that I want to communicate. So at the risk of me being a little bit uncomfortable, more uncomfortable with the way I dress, I would rather do that to set my clients at ease, that if they have a certain perception or have a certain perception that they want. Now, I'm not going to go out of my way to please somebody if their perception is wrong. I'll try to reset those expectations instead. But I understand the value of that now.
Yeah, I think professionalism, it goes hand in hand with sort of maturity.
Mm, yep.
Right. And the more experience you have, you know, the longer you've been doing something. And like you said many times, I completely relate. I do not think I respected my employer. You know, not like a person. You know, I loved my boss, but like the employer, the institution, I don't right. think I respected it. And so I didn't care about what I wore, and I didn't care what time I came in, and I didn't care if anyone was affected by it.
Yeah.
Because I was young and cocky and just didn't care. It's so different now.
I feel like that transitions nicely to the next question we have. The fact that the web is, I feel like, inherently a very casual place compared to, you know, other industries. It's very natural for all three of us to be like, yep, just jeans and a t-shirt all day, every day. But with that in mind, it becomes possibly difficult for some people to recognize the difference between a social and a professional setting. But is there actually a difference, especially if you're at work?
I mean, that's a really difficult question. I mean, I think that's what our industry is struggling with now, just in general, right? Like, there are, at surface value, it's easy to be casual, right? Because our job doesn't require us to be stuffy, right? We don't have to wear suits and dress up very formally to do what we do. We sit at computers all day. We slouch. We look at Facebook. You know, we tweet. Like, those are things that are frowned upon in, you know, quote unquote, formal work environment. I'm working with a very corporate client right now, and I went in for a meeting a couple weeks ago, and the day before the meeting, the CMO sent us an email to tell us that it was okay to come business casual to that meeting. I was like, what? What are you talking about? Like, I was going to wear jeans. But, and even in mocking up their leadership page, and I just put placeholder images in of some, like, whatever, like, hipster CEO and all the casual, like, tech companies, and she was like, this is unacceptable. Like, we would never look like this. Like, this man's face isn't even shaven. And I'm like, oh man, that's crazy. So I think at face value, it's easy to be like, oh, we're a casual industry. But I think there's a difference between casual in attitude and casual and like cavalier about the type of work that we do. So I know you guys know for me that I'm a big proponent of value pricing, and that inherently is a thing that kind of helps me understand what I'm doing on a project. So regardless of the pricing methodology, I don't think this is the forum to talk about that. But understanding why people are hiring me and writing a proposal to that, and then trying to follow through on that if I win the project, right? Something like that becomes, they're hiring me because their company needs to make money, otherwise they're going to go out of business, right? And so my work is potentially going to help them stay in business. That is not a casual thing. And I don't want to treat that casually because I feel like it disrespects the person who's hiring me. So I think there's a difference between appearing casual and dressing casual and talking casually. I think that all of that stuff is good. But I think a lot of us are in serious businesses and people do hire us because we have a skill that helps them in a way that they can't be helped on their own and they can't do it on their own. And I don't think that that's a casual thing. I think it's a serious thing. I think we can have fun doing that, but fun is different than casual.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was just thinking Leah and I attended this conference last month. And one of the rules was business casual. And I like sent Leah an email. I'm like, what the hell is business casual these days? I don't even know. This sounds so immature and juvenile. And I can recognize that now. So I guess that means I'm growing. But I didn't want to do that. I'm like, I wear jeans. You know what I mean? Like, I'm comfortable in jeans. Like, I kind of got this like dumb attitude in my head. And then I was like, wait, you are going to this conference to meet other business owners that might be your clients. You need to dress the way they're expecting you to dress, the way they're asking you to dress. Get over yourself. It's funny because, you know, I've literally, even though I've only been working for myself for 5 years, I've been working from home for over 10. And you really do have to kind of catch yourself, you know, realize that just because that's the norm for you in your environment doesn't mean it's acceptable in other environments. And you do have to bend.
Yeah. I mean, I think it goes back to looking out for somebody else, right?
Exactly.
Like, for me, it's like, if I had my own choice, I would wear a t-shirt and jeans and sneakers everywhere. That's my favorite outfit. I have many of them and I will continue to wear those. But that's me. That's what I want to do. So if somebody else wants me to do something else, I'm happy to have that conversation with them and I should be willing to do that. Otherwise, I shouldn't be willing to meet with them in the first place or go to that thing. I feel like it's a self-selection mechanism. If I don't want to dress business casual to business casual conference, I probably shouldn't go because maybe that thing is not for me. You know, maybe I don't fit there intentionally. And I think that's okay. Like, that's fine if that thing is not for me. I mean, Leah, to your original question about like, how do you know the difference between social and professional settings? I think it's very tricky to know the difference. And so for me, I just default to professional. Right. Nothing is a social setting then. Like, what is a social setting for me is like hanging out with my kids at the park. Like, that's what this profession is for me. It's the way to be able to spend time with my family. So anything that's work-related is professional. And anything that's not work-related is not professional. And I feel like it's definitely a black and white line. And there is a lot of gray area. But trying to make it more black and white for me at least lets me know how I think I should behave.
I think that's also important to apply, particularly at like conferences and stuff where you're in a professional environment, but it's very social, especially, you know, after parties or dinners and things like that. Again, I feel like it's something that I didn't know earlier in my career, but I now understand very clearly of even when you're having cocktails afterwards, that's a professional environment. You need to behave as such, and your peers should behave as such as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things that reminds me that those are still professional events, like you go to a conference and then you go to an after party, that's a professional event. You know why? Because I can write it off on my taxes,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I can write that off, that means I have to act professionally because it is professional, you know? So I think like, I just try to keep that in mind. I'm going to deduct this check, this dinner that I'm going out to with a bunch of friends. It is a tax deduction. That means it's professional. That means I need to act professionally. That means there are certain jokes that I may make with my friends that I'm not going to make in that setting. You know, even though it might be okay, I'm just going to default to not doing that because it's more professional for me to do that.
So at the end of the day, a lot of it really is context, right? Because it's funny that Emily mentioned the conference we went to and the business casual, but when we actually attended, everyone had a different interpretation of what that meant. So we had, you know, women wearing like flowery maxi dresses, you know, but with a blazer, and other people like full on suit. And then other ones where they did wear jeans, but we were in Texas. So it was kind of like, oh.
Dark jeans.
Yeah, exactly. With like cowboy boots, but then they have a blazer. It's as if once you put on the blazer, whatever else you wear, whatever else you wear is suddenly business. But I feel like a lot of the times how they're presenting themselves is also reflective of their business. If you are in the fashion industry, you wouldn't be wearing just the black and white pantsuit. You need to be able to reflect the brand of your service or company and a product or whatever. And this was an entrepreneurship conference with a variety of businesses. And when you actually went to their booths and stuff, then it all fit. It all made sense. But sometimes when you look at it as this giant amalgam of people, it just seems so random.
Yeah. I mean, to me, like, it comes back to accountability, right? So like the first two pieces, we have to have a standard, and then we have to have a way to measure that standard. So if somebody says business casual, we haven't agreed to a standard yet. I appreciate when I see things like, this is what business casual means. It means no jeans. It means ties and jackets for gentlemen. It means, you know, dresses in this style for women. And like those kind of things at least sets a standard. So if somebody shows up in jeans and it said no jeans, you are clearly in violation of that standard, right? And then you can get whatever, kicked out or reprimanded or whatever the consequences for that thing. You know, I appreciate that. Even sometimes it's more awkward to do that because you're like, wow, they're being really stuffy about it. But at least the expectation is set, you know, and that way you know how to behave. You know, I went to a wedding a couple of weeks ago, and the people getting married said, here's how we would like everybody to dress. We want you to wear summer whites, and here's a Pinterest board of all the things that we would recommend that you wear. At first, I was like, well, that's really rude. And I was like, well, wait a minute. Actually, that's great, because now I know exactly what to wear.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It made everything easy, you know? So I think, like, just being explicit about that kind of stuff can solve a lot of problems. I think the same issue is happening in our industry about the code of conduct stuff at conferences. There's code of conducts that are non-explicit. Right? They say, oh, we may do this if you do something like this. And you're like, well, I still don't understand what I can or can't do. So I think like if that stuff becomes more explicit, then you can enact those consequences or rewards or anything like that. And you can, the reward being you can create the environment that you want to create and excuse the people out who don't apply to that. However awkward it is, just sort of saying what those standards are, I think is a better thing than not.
So I think that's sort of a nice segue to one of our last questions that we have for you, which is when someone is behaving unprofessionally, whether it's on your team or maybe it's a peer at an event, what do you do? Is there anything to do, or do you just let it happen?
So the way that I try to deal with that is I try to talk to the person first one-on-one. If that doesn't work, then I raise that to, if it's a work environment, I raise that to the supervisor or whoever the manager or something like that is. And if that doesn't work, then I got to walk away. So I think those are sort of the steps that I take. And I learned that from people doing that to me. I remember at the last agency that I worked at, a big spaceship, I had one of my friends, Jamie, there. Like, he wasn't my boss. He wasn't anything. He was a peer of mine. And one day he was like, hey, can I talk to you in the conference room? And I was like, sure. And he pulled me aside and he shut the door. And he said, you need to stop being negative. And I was like, well, excuse me? Like, what? What are you talking about? And he's like, you are very negative on the project that you're working on, and it is infecting everybody on your team. Everyone is being negative because of you. If you act positive, then everyone on your team will be positive. But right now you're acting negative, and everyone is acting negative about this project. And he was on a different team, and he wasn't my boss. Like, we were technically on the same level of the totem pole in the organization, like any of that stuff. But he was like enough of a friend to me to pull me aside and tell me about that. You know, and that has always stuck with me, that he did that for me because he was looking out for me. And so he wasn't like, even though it came off as him scolding me, he was actually doing something really great for me. And so I try to take that approach with other people. If I have a problem with somebody, if I don't think someone's behaving the way that we've set as the standard, then I'll pull them aside and I say, hey, I have an issue with this. Can we work this out? And if it doesn't work, then I'll raise that to their supervisor or something like that. And if that doesn't work, then I'll say, you know what, I'm sorry, but I don't think that I can work on this project because we don't see eye to eye, and someone is going to lose out on this. And so I would rather you have your way, and I'll walk away and I'll work on something else. So those are usually the steps that I take.
What about if it's a client who's behaving unprofessionally?
Yeah, same deal there. I've done the same thing where if somebody is behaving unprofessionally, I'll give them a call and I'll just say, hey, like, this has been a little bit weird for me. Like, can we talk about this? And if they say, no, we can't talk about it, if they're just obstinate about it, then I'll raise it to someone else, right? Maybe it's their manager, or maybe it's their procurement department or something like that. And if that doesn't work, then I'll just say, I'm sorry, I'm happy to recommend you to someone else that will work better with you in the way that you want to work, but this is not a good fit. Like, I'm not going to be happy with the output. Neither are you. There's no need for us to continue to work together. I would rather lose money on a project like that than try to continue doing that project because it will ultimately cost more in the end. So I would rather just suffer through, well, I don't have any other projects, or, you know, or my cash flow sucks. Like, I'd rather go get a bank loan than to suffer through a project like that.
What about when it's yourself? You described the situation where your colleague pointed it out to you, but do you think there were any cues that you had been not paying attention to that you could have caught your own unprofessional behavior before someone else pointed it out?
I don't know. That's a good question. Probably. Like, so I think part of it was that I was just so heads down in that project. And things were so hectic that I probably just didn't realize it. That's like one of the things that our industry is really, it runs rampant in our industry, is that we work really hard, and sometimes we work really hard on really fast things. And so we don't have time to evaluate. So one of the things that I feel like I'm fortunate to do now is that I don't have a lot of production role on a project anymore. Like I don't really do a lot of design or code or anything like that. I'm mostly brought in as to do creative direction or something like that. So that I try to make that my role in the project is give everyone else enough breathing room that they can do that for themselves. And that might mean like pushing a deliverable off. It might mean creating a little bit extra time for someone. It might mean that I need to do their work for a day so that they have some time to breathe. And so like whatever that thing is, I'll try to do that thing. And so I try to look for that role. And if no one has that role, then I'll take it on. So I think every team should have that, whether it's the project manager or the producer on that team to create that space for everybody else, whether it's the creative director or the owner of the company. I think that's really valuable because when you have your people working too hard, they're not able to see things like how much they're bringing the team down or like that they haven't eaten in 2 days and like that kind of stuff. There's no reason for us. We make websites. There's no reason for us to miss a meal. Like if you're a brain surgeon, maybe, but there's no reason for us to be negative or depressed or whatever, because our jobs are to code and push pixels around in Photoshop and help people solve their business problems. You know, I think like having someone that has a dedicated role of making sure that everyone on the team is healthy, I think that's a really important thing.
Yeah, I can relate to that because right now I'm running on fumes and not a lot of sleep. And it's because I'm working fast and furious to try and catch up on a deadline I'm behind on. And it does. It creates this environment where I've got blinders on. I'm not fully paying attention to all the other things going on. And I know it's, but this is the first time I've sort of been in this situation. I'm kind of trying to be aware of it because I've got a lot of things that I'm juggling right now. And I don't want to drop the ball on any of them. And I don't want to behave unprofessionally, you know, and I still want to get the work done. And I feel like for me, ultimately, at the end of the day, you can only do what you can do in a given day. So I'm trying to remind myself of that, but recognize that I'm highly stressed right now, that I'm highly focused on one thing, and that I have to take the time to check in with Leia, let her know where I am, you know, have someone to talk to about this.
Absolutely. I mean, that's not good for you or your clients or anybody for you to be, you know, overworked on stuff. When I was younger, I did a lot of therapy and group therapy as well. My wife was in school for psychology and we did a lot of that stuff together, especially when we were about to get married. And one of the things that has always stuck with me from the group therapy that we did was that with every period of exhaustion comes a period of depression. Like whenever you're overworked, you start to feel bad. And that doesn't mean that you are depressed, but sometimes you're just like I feel awful. And when you feel awful, it comes out in your work, you know, whether you realize it or not. In the same way that like if, you know, I watch a ton of cooking shows and when people cook angry, their food doesn't taste good. I feel like the same thing is true with when you're angry and you're coding, it comes out in your code. When you're angry and you're designing, it comes out in your design, whether you realize it or not. So I think it's important for everybody to have like a good balance of things, of rest, of work, of hard times, of soft times, like all of that stuff. You know, I think it produces better work.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's hard to achieve sometimes, but if you're at least trying to make yourself aware of your situation, instead of just blindly going through it, it can help a little bit. I'm feeling like because I'm letting Leia know where I am, because I'm keeping clients informed of where I am, that I can just try and do what I can do today and not stress out too much, not miss too much sleep, you know, just kind of cut down on it a little bit.
Yeah, and I would have to say, you know, those weekly check-ins, like I had low-level anxiety before that because you're always kind of wondering, like, do they know? Are they thinking we're not doing anything? We're still working, you know?
Yep.
And then it's funny that like by us implementing something like a weekly check-in, and it's not like we don't write a novel.
Yeah, it's a couple minutes.
Yeah, we literally go, here's what happened last week to remind them what happened. Here's what we expect from you this week. And here's what you expect from us this week. And that's all it is. But just putting it out there, you know, gets rid of the anxiety that no one knows what anyone's doing.
The last agency I worked at, Big Spaceship, the CEO, Mike Lebowitz, he's like one of my best mentors that I've ever worked with. I learned so much from him. And every review that I would do with him, he would always say to me, you're doing too much stuff like in your head and like without anybody else knowing it. And he was like, make the covert overt. He's like, that's a thing. He's like, I learned that from my therapist. Make the covert overt. And so that's another thing that I always try to remember. Like if I'm doing something, even if it's a good thing and I'm keeping it to myself, somebody else should probably know about it just so they they know what I'm doing. And if it's a great thing, they can look forward to it. If it's not a good thing, they could be like, hey, probably shouldn't waste your time on that thing. And so, you know, I could spend all day just stewing in my own head about things that I think I should do or think I should be doing or not be doing. So just making it overt to everyone else that you're working with, I think, is a good thing.
So last question, you mentioned Andy Rutledge's design professionalism resource at the outset of this episode, but are there any other resources that you would recommend to help, you know, improve one's professionalism?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are really great books about things like leadership that I've been reading a lot lately. I find that it's really fascinating, and I learn a lot by reading about how other people are good leaders and are good professionals. Those are certainly great things. So the one I'm reading right now is called Leaders Eat Last by Simon Sinek. He's done a bunch of TED Talks on like leadership and creativity. And he's written a lot of good books. So those are good. On my docket to read is a book called Turn the Ship Around. I think David Marquette is the author. And it's about a Navy captain who talks about like how he led his troop in the Navy. Related to design, Design is a Job by Mike Montero is a great book in the A Book Apart series. It's particularly good because you get sort of the flavor of Mike in the book as well, so it's entertaining. And then I think just in general, like, I can't stress enough the importance of good mentors. If there's someone that you're like, that person is a professional, I can't stress enough, like, just ask them if they could spend some time, like, buy them lunch, buy them a cup of coffee, and just be like, can you just tell me stuff about how to be a professional? I think everyone likes that when someone comes up to them and asks them, like, hey, can you teach me a thing? So I think email somebody and ask them, hey, can you just spend 10 minutes with me on Skype and just talk to me about being professional? I feel like that's how I've gotten a lot of wisdom from other people, is just email them and saying, like, I would like to have lunch with you. I don't know about what, but I just kind of want to be in your presence for a little while. So some of that can kind of rub off on me. So I think that's certainly a great thing to do as well. Just reach out to people that you think are good professionals and just ask them for advice. You know, I think people love giving advice out.
Awesome. Ah, damn, we can talk about this all day.
Forever.
Forever and ever. But we do have to finish up, but we have our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, first question. Android or iOS?
I just switched to Android.
If you were stranded on a desert island and can only bring three things, what would you bring?
Oh, that's easy. Emily, Sitta, and Charlotte.
Aww. What's your favorite TV show?
Ever or right now?
Both.
Either.
Arrested Development.
Nice.
Good one. What's your favorite dessert?
New York cheesecake.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Musician.
What profession would you not like to try?
Musician.
What's the latest article or blog post you read?
Disabling Comments, a debate that cuts to the core of online news on Medium.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Flight.
What music do you like to work to?
Explosions in the Sky.
I have to ask, what is that? Is that literally a thing?
Yeah, it's like, I guess, post-rock, like ambient instrumental music. Okay. Yeah, I can't listen to stuff with words.
I was like, wow, so like you only work on 4th of July?
Yeah, one day a year I get a lot done.
All right, last question, cats or dogs?
Cats.
Nice. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
I write on my website, danielmall.com. I'm also Daniel Mall on Twitter. And the agency I run is called Superfriendly, so superfriend.ly or superfriendlyco on Twitter.
Thanks, Dan. This was a great conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Pixel and Tonics Craft.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech, Devotee, and EE Insider.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes, or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we're going to talk to Phil Smith about the Perch CMS, including e-commerce with Shop and the new Perch Runway framework. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara.
And Emily Lewis.
Signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.